A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the weird resilience of airport bookstores. Print book sales have been flat or declining for 15 years. But you walk through any major terminal, and there's a Hudson Booksellers doing brisk business at 7 in the morning. He's asking three things. Who actually runs these networks of airport bookstores? What are the major routes through which authors get on their shelves, and are there understood publishing formulas for what sells in that captive audience environment? It's a supply chain question disguised as a book question, and I love it.
It's a supply chain question wrapped in a psychology question wrapped in a real estate question. And the real estate is where you have to start, because the economics are so different from anything else in book retail. A typical mall bookstore pays maybe 5 to 10% of gross revenue in rent. An airport bookstore pays 20 to 35%, sometimes more at the major hubs. So every square foot of shelf space has to earn its keep in a way that a suburban Barnes & Noble never has to think about.
35% off the top before you've paid a single employee or kept the lights on. That's not a bookstore business. That's a convenience retail business that happens to sell books.
And that's why the companies that run these stores are not book companies. The two big ones in North America are Hudson Group and Paradis Lagardère. Hudson operates over 1,000 locations across the continent, but most of those are Hudson News newsstands, where books are just one category next to the bottled water and the neck pillows. Paradis Lagardère has about 800 locations. Between them, they control roughly 70% of U.S. airport book retail. In the U.K. and Europe, it's W.H. Smith Travel. Over 600 travel locations, same model, same economics.
Hudson Group was acquired by Dufry, the Swiss travel retail giant, which then merged with Avolta. So the bookstore where you bought that Malcolm Gladwell paperback is ultimately owned by a $15 billion travel retail conglomerate that also sells you duty-free perfume and overpriced sunglasses.
The Avolta merger closed in 2024. It created one of the largest travel retail companies in the world. So when you're browsing that staff picks table at JFK, you're browsing inventory selected by a category manager working for a publicly traded Swiss company whose core competency is moving product through high-rent transit spaces. This is not your local independent bookseller. Think about the cognitive dissonance there for a second. You're in a space that's designed to feel like a curated, almost intimate browsing experience. The warm lighting, the wooden shelves sometimes, the handwritten style signage, but the decisions behind every single thing you see were made in a corporate headquarters in Basel.
A staff picks in quotes, heavy, heavy quotes.
The staff picks are not picked by staff, but we'll get to that. The point is, the concession model shapes everything downstream. Airport authorities issue requests for proposals for retail space. The big concession companies bid for exclusive 5 to 10 year leases. The rent is a percentage of gross, not net, gross. So the concessionaire has to generate volume, consistently, across hundreds of locations. That means inventory decisions are hyper-optimized for velocity. Every title on that shelf is there because someone ran the numbers and determined it would sell fast enough to justify the rent.
The gatekeepers are not passionate booksellers. They're category managers working with velocity algorithms and placement fee spreadsheets. Which brings us to the second question. How do books actually get on those shelves? What are the routes?
Three main routes. Route 1, direct distribution, deals with the major publishers. Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Hachette. All of them have dedicated mass market sales teams whose entire job is airport and travel retail. They negotiate directly with Hudson and Paradis. They pay placement fees. They run co-op marketing. This is the primary route for new releases from established authors.
Let's put numbers on that.
$5,000 to $50,000 per title for premium positioning. Front of store tables, end caps, the staff pick signage, the shelf at eye level near the register. This is not a secret. It's standard trade practice. Publishers pay for placement in every retail channel. Supermarkets, drugstores, big box stores. Airport bookstores just charge more because the rent is so much higher. If you want your book on the front table at Hudson Booksellers at Newark Terminal C, your publisher is writing a check.
That's not payola in the legal sense. It's co-op advertising. The publisher is buying the real estate, same as they'd buy an end cap at Target.
It's disclosed, it's negotiated, it's part of the marketing budget. But it means that the front of the store, the part that looks most like thoughtful curation, is actually paid placement, optimized for titles that already have marketing momentum. Route 2 is wholesale through Ingram Content Group or Baker & Taylor. These are the big book wholesalers who supply the evergreen titles, the perennial bestsellers, the classics, the reference books, the travel guides, the stuff that doesn't need a placement fee because it sells itself. Your airport copy of To Kill a Mockingbird or The Great Gatsby came through wholesale. The category manager sets a reorder threshold, and when stock dips below it, Ingram ships more. Independent publisher programs. Smaller presses can pay for what's called in-cap placement or promotional positioning, but it's expensive and the bar is high. Hudson and Paradies have vendor programs where indie publishers can apply, but they're looking for books that meet the velocity requirements and the visual formula. If you're a small press and your book doesn't look like it belongs in an airport, it's not getting in, no matter how much you pay.
Let's talk about that visual formula, because this is where it gets genuinely interesting. The airport book is a specific design object. It's not the same book you'd buy at a neighborhood bookstore.
The industry has a term for it. They call it 15-foot readability. You need a cover that communicates genre and tone from 15 feet away, because that's the distance from the gate seating area to the bookstore entrance. High contrast, bold typography, author name in large type. For nonfiction, the subtitle has to answer the question, "What will I know after reading this?" And it has to answer it in under 2 seconds. For fiction, the cover has to telegraph the exact emotional experience. Is this going to make me cry on the plane? Is this going to make me feel smart? Is this going to distract me from the turbulence?
James Patterson is the canonical example here. His books are designed with a specific airport cover template. White background, red title, author name, and all caps at the top. It's been tested in focus groups. It's optimized for recognition at distance. You see that white and red block from 100 feet, and you know exactly what you're getting.
Patterson is the best-selling author in airport bookstores consistently year after year. His books move through those shelves faster than anything else. The formula extends beyond the cover. Airport books tend to have shorter chapters. Because the reader is constantly being interrupted by boarding announcements, by the drink cart, by the person in the middle seat elbowing them, they need natural stopping points. The prose tends to be more propulsive, less lyrical. The plot has to hook in the first 3 pages because the buyer is making a decision in the 3 minutes between purchasing and boarding.
Propulsive, not lyrical, is a great way to put it. It's functional fiction, the book equivalent of an airport sandwich. It's not the best you've ever had, but it does exactly what you need it to do right now.
That's not a criticism. It's just a different design brief. The airport book is solving a different problem than the book you buy at your local indie. It's solving the problem of, I have 4 hours in a metal tube and I need something that will hold my attention without requiring anything from me that I don't have to give right now.
There's an interesting parallel here with how airport food is designed. Airport restaurants have to deal with the fact that a significant portion of their customers have diminished taste perception because of cabin pressure and dry cabin air. Studies have shown that our ability to taste sweet and salty drops by about 30% at altitude, so airport food is often overseasoned to compensate. It's engineered for the environment. Airport books are doing the same thing. They're engineered for the cognitive environment of travel. The shorter chapters, the propulsive pacing. The high concept premise you can grasp in one sentence. That's the literary equivalent of extra salt.
It extends further. Just as airport restaurants know you're probably eating alone and design their seating and service flow around solo diners in a hurry, airport bookstores know you're probably browsing alone, slightly disoriented, with 17 minutes until boarding. The entire store layout is designed around that 17-minute window. High-margin impulse items near the register, bestsellers at eye level, the periodicals up front so you can grab and go. The deeper brow sections, the history, the science, the literary fiction, push to the back, because if you're back there, you've already committed.
We've got the gatekeepers, the roots, and the visual formula. But the third part of the question is about the publishing formulas more broadly. What type of work sells well in this context? And I think this is where the demographic targeting gets surgical.
Let's talk about the business and leadership section. This is the most carefully curated real estate in the entire store. It's usually 20 to 30 titles, rotated monthly. Publishers pitch books into this section based on three criteria. 1. Author platform. Does this person have a speaking career, a consulting practice, a newsletter with six figures of subscribers? 2. Corporate bulk purchase potential. Will CEOs buy 500 copies for their team? 3. What I've heard called airport credibility. Has this author been on a morning show recently? Were they on a podcast that business travelers listen to? Do they look like the kind of person a VP of sales wants to be seen reading?
Airport credibility is such a perfect phrase. It's not about whether the book is good. It's about whether the book functions as a social signal in the specific context of business travel.
The social signal varies by airport. The business section at JFK Terminal 4, which is heavy on finance, international banking, global macroeconomics, looks different from the business section at LAX Terminal 5, which leans more toward entertainment industry, media, and tech. The category managers know the demographic profiles of each terminal and curate accordingly. A book about venture capital might do well at SFO, but flop at DFW, where the business traveler is more likely to be in energy or logistics.
The same book can be a hit in one airport and a return in another, just based on who's flying through. That's a level of market segmentation you don't see anywhere else in book retail. A Barnes & Noble in Dallas and a Barnes & Noble in San Francisco are going to have broadly similar inventory. But Hudson at DFW and Hudson at SFO are effectively different bookstores.
That's where the velocity data gets granular, which brings us to the pop fiction section, which operates on a completely different logic. High volume, fast turnover, brutal math. Books in the pop fiction section have a shelf life of 4 to 6 weeks. If a title doesn't sell 3 copies per week, per location, it's pulled and returned to the publisher, and the publisher eats the shipping cost both ways.
3 copies a week. That's the line between survival and oblivion.
At a single location. Multiply that across 1,000 locations and you're talking about real volume. But the point is, the system is designed to be ruthless. It favors established series, brand name authors, books that can be described in one sentence. It's like Gone Girl but on a cruise ship. That kind of pitch. If your book requires a paragraph to explain, it's not going to work in the pop fiction section, because the buyer is making the decision in under 30 seconds.
This creates a hit or bust dynamic that's even more extreme than regular trade publishing. In a regular bookstore, a mid-list title might sit on the shelf for months, slowly finding its audience. In an airport, you've got 4 weeks to prove yourself or you're out.
That dynamic shapes what gets published in the first place. Publishers know the airport numbers. They know that a book that cracks the airport channel can add tens of thousands of units in sales. So they're designing books from the ground up with the airport in mind. The cover, the title, the subtitle, the chapter length, the pacing, all of it is optimized for that 30-second purchasing decision at the gate.
There's a case study I want to bring in here, because it illustrates the psychology perfectly. Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. According to a publisher's weekly analysis, 40% of its total copies in its first year were sold through airport channels. That's not a book that happened to do well in airports. That's a book that was designed for airports, whether Gladwell knew it or not.
Short chapters, counterintuitive premise, subtitle that promises you'll understand something new about how your own mind works. It's the perfect airport book. You can read a chapter between boarding groups. You can put it down and pick it up without losing the thread. And when you finish it, you feel smarter. That's the key. The airport book has to deliver a return on the time investment that the reader can feel immediately.
This connects to something I've been thinking about. The psychology of the captive audience. Travelers are in what you might call a liminal state. They're between destinations, between identities. They buy books that represent the person they want to be at the other end of the flight. The beach read represents the relaxed vacation self. The business book represents the competent professional self walking into the conference. The self-help book represents the improved self they're going to become, starting Monday.
This is why airport bookstores sell disproportionately high volumes of what you'd call aspirational nonfiction. Books about habits, productivity, self-improvement, leadership. The traveler is in a moment of transition. They're more open to the idea of transformation. The book becomes a talisman. Even if they never finish it, and the data suggests many of them don't, the purchase itself is the ritual. Buying the book is the commitment to becoming the person who reads that kind of book.
Which is why Ryan Holiday's The Obstacle is the Way became such a phenomenon in airports. It's a book about Stoic philosophy, but it was positioned in the business section. The cover and the subtitle, Turn Your Trials into Triumph, fit the aspirational formula perfectly. It didn't look like a philosophy book, it looked like a leadership book, and it sold accordingly.
Holiday's team understood the assignment. They knew that if the book landed in the philosophy section, it would sell to a tiny fraction of the audience. But in the business section, it spoke to the traveler who wanted to feel like they were learning something practical and actionable during their flight. It's a stoicism book that dresses like a McKinsey deck. And that's not a criticism. It's good marketing.
There's a fascinating tension here between what the book promises and what the reader actually does with it. I'm curious, do we have any data on completion rates for airport book purchases? Because my suspicion is they're abysmal.
They are not great. The best estimate I've seen, and this is from a 2019 industry survey that Hudson conducted internally, it leaked to Shelf Awareness, suggested that only about 30% of airport book purchases are ever finished. And that number drops to something like 15% for business books. The books are bought, they're started on the plane, and then they're abandoned. Left in hotel rooms, left in seat back pockets, put on a shelf at home and never touched again.
Here's the thing, does that matter? From the publisher's perspective, a sale is a sale. From the reader's perspective, the purchase already served its psychological function. You bought the book because you wanted to be the kind of person who reads books about Stoic philosophy on planes. The transaction completed that desire. The reading is almost secondary.
It's the same psychology as gym memberships sold in January. The purchase is the commitment device. Whether you actually go to the gym 12 times a month or 4 times a month, the gym already has your money. And you already got the emotional benefit of feeling like you're taking action. The airport book is a commitment device for the self you want to be when you land.
Let's talk about the e-book paradox, because this is the part that surprises people. Airport bookstores are thriving because of e-books, not despite them.
The numbers are striking. A 2024 survey by the Airport Book Retailers Association found that 62% of airport book buyers are regular e-reader users. They read on Kindle or Kobo or their phone at home. But they make an exception for travel. Battery anxiety is real. You forgot to charge your Kindle, or you don't want to drain your phone battery on a long flight. The paperback doesn't need a battery. It doesn't need to be put in airplane mode. It doesn't get confiscated during takeoff and landing.
Also, there's a social dimension. Reading a paperback on a plane is invisible in a way that reading on a device isn't. Nobody's going to ask you about your paperback. But if you're holding a Kindle, the person next to you might want to talk about it. The paperback is a privacy shield.
There's the souvenir aspect. Airport book purchases often function as mementos of the trip. You bought that thriller at Heathrow on the way to your first trip to London. You bought that business book at O'Hare before the big pitch meeting. The physical object carries the memory of the context in a way that a downloaded file doesn't.
The physical book is a memory anchor. That's something ebooks structurally cannot replicate. You can't sign a Kindle file. You can't put an ebook on your shelf and see it 5 years later and remember where you were when you read it. I have a beat-up copy of a Paul Theroux travel book I bought at the old Hong Kong Kai Tak Airport in 1996. The cover is torn, there's a coffee stain on page 40-something, and every time I see it on my shelf, I'm back in that terminal, watching the planes come in over Kowloon. A Kindle file doesn't do that.
That's the thing the ebook evangelists never quite understood. A book is not just a delivery mechanism for text, it's an object that accumulates meaning through the circumstances of its acquisition and use. The airport book you bought during a 6-hour delay becomes part of the story of that trip. The ebook you downloaded at home before you left for the airport doesn't carry the same weight.
The ebook didn't kill the airport bookstore. It just clarified what the airport bookstore is actually selling. It's not selling access to text. It's selling an object that fits into a specific moment of travel, that serves a psychological function, that solves a set of problems the traveler didn't even know they had until they walked past the store.
Which brings us to the question of what this means for authors. If you're a writer and you want your book on those shelves, what do you actually do?
Let's say I'm a mid-list author. I've got a book coming out. It's good. I believe in it. How do I even start?
First, you need a publicist who has travel-retail relationships. This is not something you can do on your own. The category managers at Hudson & Paradies don't take calls from authors. They take calls from the dedicated mass market sales teams at the major publishers, and from a handful of independent publicists who built those relationships over years. If your publicist doesn't know the buyer at Hudson, your book is not getting in through the front door. And I want to emphasize how small this world is. There are maybe 12 people in the entire United States who make the actual buying decisions for airport book retail. 12 people deciding what millions of travelers see.
Second, your cover has to pass the 15-foot test. And this is something you can control, especially if you're self-publishing or working with a small press. High contrast, bold typography, clear genre signaling, subtitle that answers the "what will I know?" question in under 2 seconds. If your cover is subtle, artistic, or requires interpretation, it's dead on arrival in an airport.
Third, you need to pitch your book as solving a problem the traveler didn't know they had. This is the hardest part for a lot of authors because they think of their book in terms of its content, not its function. But the airport buyer is not asking, "What is this book about?" They're asking, "What will this book do for me during my flight?" If your book can answer that question in a single sentence, you've got a shot.
For publishers, the airport channel is also a testing ground for mass market appeal. Books that perform well in airports often predict broader breakout success. If a title is moving at 3 copies a week across 300 airport locations, that's a signal that it has legs in the wider market. Smart publishers track airport sales as an early indicator.
The channel is growing. Print book sales overall have been flat or declining since 2010, but airport retail has been growing at 3-4% annually, driven by the travel recovery and by the captive audience dynamics we've been talking about. As long as people keep flying, they'll keep buying books at airports. The channel is resilient in a way that mall bookstores are not.
To summarize the supply chain for the listener who's been taking notes, the stores are run by Hudson Group and Paradies Lagardère in North America, WH Smith in Europe, all of them travel retail conglomerates that bid for long-term airport leases. Books get on shelves through 3 routes. Direct publisher deals with placement fees, wholesale through Ingram or Baker & Taylor for evergreen titles, and independent programs for small presses with deep pockets. The visual formula is 15-foot readability, high contrast, clear genre signaling, subtitle that answers the utility question. The psychology is aspirational. Travelers buy books that represent the person they want to be when they land.
The whole system is optimized to the millimeter. Every title, every cover, every placement is a data-driven decision. The front table is paid for. The end caps are negotiated. The local interest section is probably the only part of the store that reflects anything like genuine curation, and even that is often managed by a centralized category team that decides what local means for each terminal.
Next time you're in an airport bookstore, look at the front table. Count how many books have white covers with red titles. Count how many subtitles start with the word "how." Notice that the books at eye level are all from the same 3 publishers. You're not browsing. You're being sold to by a supply chain that has studied your behavior more carefully than you have.
That's the thing. You walk in for a bottle of water and you walk out with a $30 hardcover about leadership habits that you'll read 40 pages of and then leave in the seat back pocket. And the system is perfectly okay with that because the sale already happened.
The book you didn't finish is still a book that was sold. The supply chain doesn't care if you read it. It cares that you bought it.
Which is, when you think about it, the publishing industry in microcosm. But that's a whole other episode.
One open question before we wrap. As the travel retail industry consolidates further, and the Avolta merger suggests it will, what happens to title diversity? Does a $15 billion conglomerate with centralized buying spread the same 30 books across every airport in the world? Or does the data get so granular that it enables more niche targeting, not less? You could imagine a future where the bookstore at SFO knows that 30% of its travelers are in tech and adjusts its inventory in real time.
The countervailing force is the rise of buy online, pick up at airport services. Amazon lockers are already in a lot of terminals. BarnesandNoble.com offers airport pickup. If travelers can pre-order before they get to the airport, the impulse buy psychology collapses. You don't wander into the bookstore because you've already got your book waiting for you at the locker. That could disrupt the entire captive audience model.
I wonder about that, though. Because the impulse buy isn't just about convenience. It's about the browse. It's about the serendipity of finding something you didn't know you wanted. An Amazon locker doesn't give you that. You can't browse a locker. You can't pick up a book because the cover caught your eye from 15 feet away. The locker solves the logistics problem, but it completely fails to replicate the discovery experience.
The airport bookstore is one of the last remaining environments where serendipitous book discovery happens at scale. You're not there because you're looking for a specific title. You're there because you have time to kill and you're open to suggestion. That's a retail dynamic that's almost extinct everywhere else. Amazon's algorithms are great at showing you more of what you already like. They're terrible at showing you something you didn't know existed. The airport bookstore, for all its corporate optimization, still offers the possibility of a genuine surprise.
The airport bookstore is a perfect microcosm of late-stage publishing. Logistics, psychology, economics, all converging in a 400-square-foot space next to the Cinnabon. It's not dying, it's evolving. And the evolution is fascinating to watch.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, a British scientific expedition to Kiribati discovered a hand-cranked tide predicting machine from 1906, rusting in a colonial outpost shed. It had been built by Lord Kelvin's workshop and was one of only three ever made. The other two had been lost to scrap metal drives during the World Wars. This one survived because the local meteorological officer had been using it as a spare parts shelf and didn't know what it was.
A tide predicting machine used as shelving. There's a metaphor in there somewhere.
That's going to sit with me.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this operation running. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're back next week with another prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.